MSW Media.
Spy Talk, a podcast at the intersection of intelligence, foreign policy, national security, and military operations.
Hi there, I'm Jeff Stein.
And I'm Karen Greenberg.
And this is another edition of the Spy Talk podcast. We have a terrific guest today, Julia Curley, a former senior intelligence analyst at the CIA who has lots to say about the politicization of intelligence in this administration. And it's very disturbing. Anyway, for the meantime, however, a couple of things on our radar. Weeks ago, Karen, it was reported that the White House wants a list of all, it wants a master list of all our spies, the people who are working for CIA, et cetera, and FBI assets and so on. And they want to know who these people are. We haven't heard anything about it since then. What do you think about that?
Yeah, it's a really good question. And it's one of those more concerning questions when you think about what our intelligence community is doing and how we're defining our intelligence community.
Yeah.
Because the idea that, you know, that the intelligence agencies turn over the names of foreign espionage targets, first of all, the category is what? Who would actually would fit into that category of foreign espionage targets? You know, what would be the criteria for getting them into it? How much of an asset would they, how much of a target would they have to be to actually get on this list? But the real question is for all of the, you know, the bantering about you can't do this, you can do this, we need this for security is why? What would be the reason to do this? And the only reason would be, it seems, and I think, you know, to pick a word that's everywhere, right, these days, to weaponize those lists. And the question is, what would we be weaponizing those lists for? Would it be to actually look into the backgrounds of these people above and beyond what the intelligence agencies are doing? Is it about distrust in the intelligence community? Is it about trying to figure out another way to centralize intelligence so that it is that who has it, that the DNI has it, and that who knows who it's going to be shared with and who knows?
Well, I can't think of a worse security issue than putting the names of all our covert agents. These are not Americans working for CIA or something. These are the Russians, let's say, who are working for CIA and risking their lives.
Right.
In fact, pardon me for going dark here, but why would you want to know all the Russians working for CIA? I can only think of the worst things, considering the Russia issue with Trump. Anyway, moving along, this whole Air Force One imbroglio, whatever we want to call it, in Turkey, you know, the fake boarding by Trump and getting into another plane, flying off and leaving the press on the Air Force One. Apparently, there was credible intelligence that the Iranians planned to shoot Air Force One out of the sky. Someone had reported someone with a shoulder-fired missile within range of the plane at the airport in Ankara. You know, there's been a lot of talk about this. Obviously, Richard Haass, the director emeritus of the Council on Foreign Relations, suggested that maybe we should rethink assassinations. Maybe we shouldn't be willy-nilly knocking off people because, you know, we could get a little bit of that medicine ourselves. No matter what you think of President Trump, you don't want him assassinated. That would just be a terrible trauma for this country. So talk about this. We have conspiracy issues rife now and after the first attempt on Trump's life at that speaking gig out in Pennsylvania, I guess it was. You know, there are still conspiracy theories swirling over that. But if he was actually killed, it would just be a terrible trauma. So we don't want to go through that.
Well, you know, the thing is that, yes, there's been all of these, you know, reports at the few that we know of, but too many of assassination attempts on on President Trump, both at home and abroad. What's interesting about when you look abroad is that, remember that the Iranians said after the killing of the assassination of Soleimani by President Trump in 2020, remember what they said? They said, we will respond in our own time, in our own way. And so it's sort of been a shadow that's been covering, you know, sort of like, you know, always being on edge about it. And I think so there's two issues here. One is the security of the president of the United States. The other is how we respond to that. And was this the way to respond in a way that, you know, sort of imperiled others for one thing, and that, correct? Right.
Yeah.
And that also raises the profile of the idea that really there are enemies of Trump's that we really have to be concerned about. And I think this very much gets to our conversation today about who's looking at this, who's thinking about this. Do we have the right intelligence sources to know where exactly those threats are and then how to prevent them?
Well, yeah, that's another issue entirely. Just Trump goes around willy-nilly threatening everyone and saying, you know, talking about regime change here and there. Cuba is on the front burner now. What's to say the Cubans wouldn't say, well, you come after us, we're going to come after you. There we are. Finally, I mean, there's a lot going on in our neck of the woods. But I just wanted to bring up very briefly some interesting developments on Cash Patel's already controversial planned trip to Moscow in October, just before the midterm elections. A Kremlin-connected commentator, Vladimir Vasilyev, a senior researcher at the Russian Academy of Sciences Institute for U.S. and Canadian Studies, suggested on TV that the FSB may offer Patel dirt on Democrats. I mean, that would be classic FSB behavior. He wrote, it is assumed that Russia has some kind of compromise on the Democrats, and it could be provided by us in one form or another to the American side. But he also suggested, what would Patel give up in exchange for that information? Any thoughts on that, Karen?
No, but I do think the thoughts about our election integrity are getting more and more complex and more frightening. And therefore, whatever, it could be many things that Kash Patel is going there for, but because the election is so much front and center in terms of administration attempts to delegitimize it, to interfere with it, and that of course this is what gets attached to it in terms of this could be about election interference both now and in the future, and you know, I think it's pretty risky to be sending him at this point in time when you think about the repercussions that it could have, not just for election integrity and how people accept the election, but for the sort of front and center, you know, if this narrative takes off. Why is this intervention starting to happen? Is this just a means of deflection or, you know, distraction? But I think it's a very odd timing, however, whatever context you put it in.
Yeah, yeah. It's this kind of commentary out in Moscow kind of serves to throw shadow on our elections. It's not so much to discredit Kash Patel, although he's a ripe target, but to just again add another conspiracy idea into the minds of American voters. How much they're paying attention to what somebody in Moscow says, who knows? But again, they just want to muddy the water, and they want to bring the United States down. That's been their goal since they consolidated the revolution in the 1920s. They are still, as many Russian commentators have known, they're still Bolsheviks at heart. The Soviet Union may be gone, but they're still very much have a clandestine mindset about foreign relations. So another issue that we just have to deal with in our elections, it's where the intelligence world and the overt world of our intelligence and our institutions combine. So anyway, we'll be keeping an eye on that. But meanwhile, let's talk about our guest, Julia Curley. We're really thrilled to have her on the show. She's a former CIA analyst with over 25 years of experience in various national security positions. She's had several high-level roles, including as a director of the National Security Council in both the Biden and second White Houses, and as a briefer to the vice president. She has completed multiple tours in the Middle East and South Asia, has worked in the CIA's China Mission Center. She holds master's degrees from the National War College and an American university. Her work focuses on U.S. foreign policy, intelligence, national security issues, and she is a contributor to Lawfare's blog and reporting. So without further ado, let's go ahead and bring Julia Curley on right now. Julia Curley, welcome to Spy Talk. Last spring, you resigned from the CIA after a distinguished 20-year career, during which you served in several high-level roles, including as an NSC director in both the Biden and the second Trump White House, and as a PDB briefer to the vice president. Not long after, you went public writing on the Lawfare site. From its first days, the second Trump administration treated the intelligence community not as an instrument of the state, but as an enemy within, a deep state that had allegedly lain in wait for the president during his first term. The aim was explicit, you wrote, put career civil servants in trauma to make them not want to come to work. At the CIA, that program arrived on schedule. I want to get back to this politicization of intelligence. But first of all, for our listeners, take us inside the room. What did you do as a senior briefer? What was a day like you like as a senior intelligence analyst?
Well, thank you, Jeff, and thanks for having me on. So I resigned earlier this year. I did so because I wanted to be able to speak publicly about what I had seen, experienced in the White House and at the CIA. I must start, of course, with the disclaimer that nothing I say here is represents the views of the United States government. I'm sure they would definitely emphasize on that point. Mm-hmm. I had a wonderful career at CIA, from being an analyst to deploying to various war zones to the White House. And so it was only with great reluctance that I walked away. But yeah, so what I said in that piece was that the administration's view of the intelligence community as the enemy within was quite well stated and publicly. All I had to do was cite their own words. Russ Vogt, the head of the Office of Management and Budget, had said quite clearly that his goal was to put federal workers in trauma, of which,
what
of
does
course,
that mean, to put you in trauma?
Well,
how does that work?
Given that we all have families, we all have a career, we all care about the mission, subjecting us to unrelenting criticism, firing some of the senior officers, some of the most respected people in our profession in public, for the crime of having disagreed with the president in their analysis, and threatening to riff or to do widespread layoffs as they had at the State Department, and the destruction of USAID, put the whole intelligence community into a defensive crouch.
So that trauma is really very personal. It's that you could get fired immediately, be frog walked out of the office if you said the wrong thing. Right? So
correct.
You would lose everything, your job, your health insurance, et cetera, et cetera. That was the trauma.
Right. We're all people. we all have material needs. And it had never been a thought that I had ever had that something I had written, let alone in some of these cases, something I wrote 10 years ago in an assessment, which had represented, this is in one of the cases, had represented the consensus viewpoint, or the certainly the vast majority viewpoint of intelligence analysts at the time, that someone would then go back in time to try to politicize or to punish those that had said the wrong thing a decade ago, because it contradicted what the president wanted to hear and violated his own feelings about the 2016 and 2020 election. These are professionals. These are nonpartisan civil servants who we all thought we had protections so that we could serve and live up to the values of the organization of speaking truth to power. But none of that turned out to be true in the breach. And so it's great sadness that I have to report just how politicized and neutered the organization has become, unable to speak truth to power, to tell the White House what it needs to hear rather than just what it wants.
So again, circle back briefly. Tell us what the life of an intelligence analyst is to start with, and then the senior intelligence analyst. So just what's your day like? You drive into headquarters at Langley, Virginia. Take your seat in a cubicle with 100 other people in cubicles. Tell us to separate the movie from the actuality.
Yeah, well, I didn't call in many drone strikes on the way to work, which you would think if you watched some of the films and TV shows about our world. You'd open up your computer overnight. You know, hundreds or thousands of reports would pour in from all around the world. The United States collects an enormous amount of information that will fit in with what you'd call your account. So if you were a China military or a Russia political or a, you know, Venezuelan leadership analyst, you would be looking for the information related to that. You, in coordination with your colleagues and your management, would decide whether there's going to be a piece that needs to be written on the topic that will, quote, advance the story that the policymaker needs to hear. Knowing key upcoming policy meetings or presidential travel was often important, so that you can be sure that the product you're writing isn't just for academic interest, but it will actually help our political leaders make better decisions. And the whole apparatus is to give the United States decision advantage over our adversaries around the world. And it's been an enormous benefit to the United States over the years to have that. And so you would write the papers, you would get it done, you would fight through the analyst on analyst violence, which is inevitably going to happen between
analyst on analyst violence,
intelligent people who disagree and have strong opinions. And then and you wrestle it to the ground with a paper that you can agree on. You fight your way through seven or eight layers of review as it gets out. And then in the case of the president's daily brief, you would produce it, at the late hours of the night, in order to then come in the early hours of the morning to brief the briefer, who would then go down and brief the principals, the customers. And later in my career, I got to serve as one of those for a vice president. And so, there is this cycle that we all would live in of writing, briefing, feedback from the customers, what worked and what didn't, what are the follow-up questions we need, and this would go around and around. We're not quite journalists, not quite academics, but it was a wonderful life and an important profession that one can give decades to, and historically that's how CIA officers did. They made it their life.
And sometimes you got a rocket from the White House. They want to know something about something. Let's take for one example the Tren de Agua. The White House, how did that work? The White House asked you to show proof that this was that this drug gang was or cartel was mobilized by the Venezuelan government to invade, quote unquote, the United States. How did that work?
Right. So you're referring to when I was actually at the NSC, serving as a director for intelligence programs at the White House. And so within the first few days of the new administration, which I had stayed over as had been historically the case, career civil servants would remain when the political appointees would depart. So there'd be continuity between the administrations. So I stayed, and within the first few days, one of the officers who worked for Stephen Miller, the new Homeland Security advisor, came over and asked me to task out a paper on Tren de Aragua. The initial version of the tasking was something to the effect of write me a paper that says, which is often what a policymaker will do, and you as an intelligence analyst have to change it into a question, because we're not just speech writers, we're analysts. And so I translated it back and I sent it to the National Intelligence Council that asked that question. Has the Maduro government directed this Venezuelan street gang to, quote, invade the United States? Which just happened to be the legal predicate for invoking the Alien Enemies Act and for many of the things the administration wanted to do. It was then sent over. The NIC worked on it. They did the normal thing of coordinating the entire intelligence community around a judgment. They produced it, and as had been the case in the past, they produced a judgment that said, no, in fact, this is a street gang, and that it had not, quote, been instructed by the government of Venezuela to invade the United States. This, of course, contradicted the position of the administration in court. It leaked somehow. Then the DNI at the time, and her chief of staff, tried to get the NIC chairman to change his analysis, to rethink it, which is just another way of saying I didn't like your answer. When they refused, they had them walked out of the building.
NIC is the National Intelligence Council.
Right. So the senior most analytic body that is coordinating the national intelligence estimates, intelligence community assessments, that sort of what is supposed to be a synthesized consensus position of the intelligence community. So it's not going to be some, outlier position. It's going to be, when the NIC is convinced, that's usually the last body that is convinced. And so firing that person, who was a respected intelligence community analyst that many of us knew personally, was a shock to the whole organization. And it just was the first among many that put the organization on its back foot. Like, if this could happen to him, it could easily happen to me. And so while politicization has happened in the past, people talk about the Iraq WMD fiasco, this was new. This was adding to the normal political pressures the threat of your own livelihood. And we had all thought that structures and values had been instilled that would protect us from that. And that, unfortunately, was not the case with this administration.
So one of the things that overlaps with your career and your decades in intelligence is the creation of the DNI and the Office of the DNI, which was a fundamental restructuring of the intelligence community after 9/11. And you really have to wonder, and I know you've written about this and talked about this, but you really have to wonder, what are the pros and cons of keeping the ODNI in place? Because if we don't keep it in place, then what do we do? And so could you just talk a little bit about how you see the creation and continuation of the ODNI as, and you can, push back on this, but as making it harder for the intelligence community rather than easier for the intelligence community in this particular time to get their facts across and conclusions across?
Yeah. So, I would first start with the sentence, reasonable people can disagree about the DNI. It's almost a religious debate among me and my friends about whether this organization should exist or not. And recent DNIs have made a pretty good case for it not existing. But let's just start at the beginning. The 9/11 happens, why people believed failure to connect the dots. We have the WMD fiasco, which is principally the intelligence community not correcting the record of what the White House wanted to hear. There were people that were trying to warn.
In particular, CIA.
Right.
Of this discussion.
Yeah, it was mainly that there was an effort by the White House to cherry pick intelligence and then the failure to correct that. Is I think how I would put the failure there. And so in the response to all of this, Congress stands up an idea that had been in circulation for some time of creating a Director of National Intelligence to try to coordinate the intelligence community so it could speak with one voice, address systematic tradecraft issues like this, manage its budget, et cetera, et cetera. And it makes a certain amount of sense because for a long time, CIA's director had this as kind of a secondary duty. In addition to running the world's premier spy agency, they also had to take care of the other 14 or so intelligence agencies, which never occupied as much of their attention for obvious reasons. And so this community management function of the CIA director had always been secondary enough and hadn't worked
really
very well.
Really tilted towards CIA.
And the outside view, was that it prioritized everything CIA said to the expense of the other agencies. So it was meant to address these issues. And unfortunately, through most of its tenure, the DNI has not been seen as a very effective answer to these problems. It's probably relieved CIA of some of the duties that it didn't want to do anyway. Had that positive in terms of coordinating the broader intelligence community, in terms of serving as the senior most intelligence officer to advise the president. it didn't quite work for a number of reasons, you know, mainly because it kind of turned into a middleman. If you wanted the answer on a particular policy problem, you either go to the agency that's writing 80% of the PDBs and has the expertise in its analytic core, the CIA director, or if it's like a signals report, you'd go to the NSA director. Why would you go to this third party, you know, middleman who often does not have as much expertise as the people running those agencies? And so it was misconceived in some of its design, but it did answer a real problem that if you talk about what comes next from this, we do have to have a plan in place. And we can talk about various ideas that are out there that I think make sense. But in the meantime, we have this institution, which has been thoroughly politicized by this administration under Tulsi Gabbard, was used to eviscerate, or the DNI had eviscerated her own workforce, destroying morale there and cutting 30-40% of workers, seemingly without any clear plan of what the destination was, of the out, you know, what did she positively see her organization, its mission, and never able to articulate that. And Pulte, who came in as the mortgage investigator, did the same thing, seemingly only interested in performative firings of the deep state to please the audience of one watching at the White House.
Yeah. To clear the room took on an entirely different meaning.
Yeah, right.
Under Gabbard and
Pulte. But to what end? Right.
Well, so the question is, you know, this idea of connecting the dots and intelligence sharing is not a bad idea, right, among the agencies. So the question is, if you dismantle this, if you think about forward steps, is there a way to keep somebody administratively in charge, which is a lot of what the CIA was willing to support, and still ensure that there is intelligence sharing going on? And you referenced, you know, thinking about the future. What are the thoughts running around there among people who have thought about this?
I think they're still pretty nascent, but I'll just lay out a few thoughts. I mean, first of all, the administration of the PDB, the running of the National Intelligence Council, there's really no reason why CIA can't do that and be the overwatch for it, as long as it behaves well with the others, you know, and is given the instruction that actually don't just, you know, mainline CIA's prerogatives. CIA is already producing most of the product. It's already providing most of the senior officers. It could handle this responsibility if it's the production of the product and the briefing of the senior customer.
Until Trump came along, I don't think we've ever seen an abolishment of an entire agency. Yeah. Well, you know, like be gone, like USAID, for example, you know, just getting rid of it.
Yeah.
So ODNI, the National Intelligence Directorate, is with us forever, most likely.
It is, yeah.
So that's what we have to live with. What do you foresee under the new management there, by the way? Any changes or a continuation of the Trump administration policy of just give us what we want to hear?
Yeah, well, I mean, for my sins, I watched the confirmation hearings of the new DNI Clayton, and I heard no articulation of his positive vision for what this organization is for. And so on important other questions about potential reform, like whether the National Counterterrorism Center, which fits under the DNI, or the National Counterintelligence Center, which also fits, do they be there, or can they be devolved back to CIA, FBI? There are lots of solutions that could be put on the table to have a much more thin and streamlined DNI focused on coordination only. But he didn't articulate any of those things. But what happened, though, as he was being coordinated, nominated, mm-hmm. Confirmed, yeah, thank you, was him denying that Joe Biden had won the 2020 election, not being able to bring himself to say the words. If the senior intelligence officer of the United States has one job, it is to speak truth to the president and tell him what he needs to know and not what he wants to hear. But instead, we were treated to a senior government official now, yet again, in public, denying the obvious and legal truth of what has occurred. And so it didn't fill me with a lot of confidence that he's going to do that. But it's not a great thing that the same outcome of eviscerating an organization or not speaking truth to power will now be covered with a more respectable veneer, since he's not going to be the, you know, given the low bar set by his predecessor, who was accused of having cult ties and showing up at a criminal investigative site within the United States, which is not a DNI responsibility.
Yeah, Tulsi Gabbard going to Georgia and looking over the
right.
Ballots.
So by that low bar, he could easily step over that and seem to be much more housebroken and normal, while also facilitating truly dangerous activity. At the top of my concern is this effort by the administration that Tulsi perfected to selectively declassify intelligence as a way of telling the president what he wants to hear, and then most dangerously, helping the president in his effort to delegitimize U.S. elections at home, which is what that speech he gave just a few weeks ago.
I want to talk about the Iran war and intelligence, but first we have to step away for a moment, take a short break. Okay, we're back. Can you give us any insight into Trump and intelligence on Iran, specifically this issue of the Strait of Hormuz? Former DNIs have even said publicly years ago that one of the options that Iran would have if we attacked them was to shut off the Strait of Hormuz. Again, can you give us any insight into how the president just ignored? We've seen some reporting that just Netanyahu just led him by the nose and persuaded him that this would be essentially a cakewalk, regime change, and so on. And he publicly said the war would be over within days or weeks. And here we are 6 months down the road and really in a mess. It seems like the Iranians have this by the short hairs. So how is it that the president could just ignore all this intelligence? And do you know if he what kind of briefing, how strenuous the briefings from intelligence analysts were about, you know, the holes in the strategy of attacking Iran?
So I'll just first of all say that by the time they got around to deciding to go to war with Iran, I had been long since purged. So I do not have any firsthand knowledge of that. But what I can talk about are a couple of key failures that led to the Iran war, both of which involved intelligence. So first of all, as you noted, this question of what the president was advised on and did he know about the Strait of Hormuz, this has been foreseeable and foreseen since I was a baby analyst. The idea that in a conflict, the Iranians would close the Strait of Hormuz or try to use that as a choke point, or that the death of the supreme leader would just simply result in the next supreme leader in the organization, in the Iranian system taking over. All of these things were widely known and wargamed in public and testified by past senior intelligence officials. So the idea that the president would be caught by surprise of these things is astonishing. And I wouldn't even call that an intelligence failure. That's a failure to listen or a failure to surround yourself with people willing to tell you unpleasant truths. The idea that they would have invited a foreign leader, Benjamin Netanyahu, into the Situation Room, this is in the Maggie Haberman, Jonathan Swan book, to directly message the president in the Situation Room with Israeli intelligence on the screen above him while the rest of our leaders sit, you know, mutely at the end of the table. Just astonishing that that would be allowed to happen. And so that relates to the second major failure, which was the destruction of the NSC as a policy coordinating body. On the third day of the administration, the White House calls an all hands and pulls together 160 career civil service officers who've been detailed to the White House, whether these are intelligence people like me or DOD and state, et cetera, who are the wiring that keep the U.S. government going, especially at a critical period like a transition, and informs them all that they have 15 minutes to walk out of the compound because they're all being fired, let go, sent back to their home agencies. No replacements lined up, no plan for what would come next. They asked me to stay, and for the next several weeks, it was a complete chaos. It was complete chaos. Choose your colorful description of a clown show in a dumpster fire in a whatever. But it was madness that they did this at the beginning, and that set the tone for repeated purges every few months, driven by online internet activists who were apparently vetting White House personnel in an astonishing
Laura
development.
Loomer.
Right. And so, of course, you didn't have a structure in place when the United States was going to make a critical deliberative decision about going to war. And as a result, you had, you know, an extremely well-planned U.S. military operation, as you would expect of the United States military, but no plan by the State Department to evacuate 500,000 U.S. citizens in the region. How was that possible, that it could have been a surprise to the State Department in a war that we started? And so it just again and again. And so the failures to inform the president, the failure to plan, all of it relates to this attack on the civil service and the resulting planning failures and unwillingness to then speak up. And we're all paying for it now. And it's hard to see a good way out. We can talk more about the Iran case if you want.
Also, there's the issue of Iranian missile targeting of U.S. bases around the Middle East. According to reporting, we've seen a failure to prepare for Iranian missile strikes, which injured and killed Americans in Jordan and elsewhere. Again, this is entirely irresponsible.
Can I ask whether any of those people, career civil servants and others, bringing up not just what would happen in terms of retaliation for the United States, but getting back to the closing of the strait and attacking foreign entities? And right, was there a lot of talk about what this would do to destabilize the Middle East and the region?
I can't imagine there could have been if there was no NSC process, if they had, like, you both lack the people willing to speak up, but also the place to speak, if they're not having regular senior working level meetings to discuss preparations for this conflict. So the president has been cocooned by his own choosing, by sycophants and people who tell him what he wants to hear. And that's obvious. And they've made no compunction that they don't want to hear from conflicting points of view. And in this case, the attacks on U.S. forces in the region, having been on the receiving end of Iranian missiles on more than one occasion in my life, like, this can't possibly have been a surprise to anyone. The idea that we would have launched a war against Iran, we had previously spent 20 years fighting wars in the countries to the left and to the right of Iran. And at the same time, we have purged the expertise and shut out the expertise of the very people that had been involved in those conflicts. And like me, many of them have now left or been either incentivized to leave, fired, or just got sick of it and quit. And it's an astonishing situation that could have been prevented in so many different ways that has now landed us in this quagmire where I see very little evidence that the Iranians are going to let us off the hook here. We're now already negotiating from a position that's worse than when the war began. I think there's a word for that when you end up with less than when you started the conflict. I think it's called losing a war. Mm-hmm. And as we get closer to the elections, you see the administration negotiating itself down to greater and greater concessions with the Iranians. And it's just been a debacle that it's hard to see how, after the mess of the Iraq war, that we could have found a way of making an even greater mess of this that may have real damage to the U.S.'s position permanently in the region.
Yeah, I mean, this, I think, is something that's starting to concern people more and more, sort of raising this point, whether, you know, talking about our relationship with the Saudis and what that means in terms of the Saudis' relationship with Iran, not to mention the other countries. So I'm wondering if you have a sense of, just looking ahead, without knowing anything from since you've been there, but just looking ahead, where you see the points of fragility that this could evolve into in the region? Like, well, a bad case scenario.
Or yeah, escalate, I mean, into.
Yeah, right. Exactly.
Well, you know, the Iranians have a strong incentive to not allow uncontrolled escalation because they've got a good thing going right now. They can use control over the Strait of Hormuz to extract ever greater concessions. The United States is the one in the position where to break out of this impossible situation, we would have to dramatically escalate the conflict in a way that is politically impossible to imagine the United States wanting to commit large-scale ground troops into the region. So we're kind of stuck.
Or a nuclear weapon.
I mean, the president's already threatened to destroy Iranian civilization several times. So it's hard to imagine what additional things he could put on the table. But if the United States had one duty to its allies and partners in the Middle East, it was keeping the flow of oil open in the Persian Gulf. And that is why they have given us basing rights, and we have these security agreements, because we serve their best interest and their economic prosperity by outsourcing to us and paying us to provide security. And we have failed on the most important aspect of it. So when this is all over, if it is over soon, I imagine that most of the countries in the region are going to have to readjust their priors, their assumptions about the value of U.S. security relationships, which, we're seeing all around the world with us tearing up our other alliances. So I don't see our way back without a significant reversal of the way this administration works. And obviously, there's no sign they're going to change.
That famous line from Ghostbusters comes to mind. Who are you going to call? You know, another really rough analogy.
Maybe they'll call Beijing. I mean, that's really the problem, that we have discredited ourselves as a security provider.
I'm doing a really rough analogy here. It's like, you know, you do it yourself, home repair, you know, you're going to fix the toilet yourself. And then after a couple of hours, suddenly the bathroom is flooded, right? And you got to find a real plumber to take care of it. I mean, who are they going to listen to give them some sound advice in a very difficult situation now? To get us out of this mess. But I just want to go back to just to level the playing field here a little bit. This isn't the first time a president or leaders have ignored intelligence or forced conclusions that were not warranted. You wrote yourself about an incident very early on in your career in Baghdad in 2005, right? Tell us about that, with this general who was looking over your shoulder.
Well, yeah, this was my first overseas assignment for the intelligence community, was to Baghdad. And I remember it quite well. And I wrote it about in the piece, where one of my first jobs was to create the morning PowerPoint slides for the general, who I will not name publicly. He, didn't like the assessment that had come out of my team and that I had been leading. It was a Baghdad security assessment that it was being prepared for him to brief President Bush in a couple hours. And he told me to get out of my chair. And he edited the PowerPoint slide as I sat there and or stood there over his shoulder and watched him delete, words.
What had you reported that he did not want in the report?
Well, I had reported that the security situation was getting worse, and he had insisted upon making it look better. So it was the graphs that showed the rising attacks that were deleted. It was the minimal progress. He deleted the word minimal, so it's more than just happy to glad. It's happy to sad, and or sad to happy in this case. And I just watched it happen in front of me, and I didn't do anything. And, I was a 23-year-old kid on my first, over 24-year-old kid on my first. So it's to show you the sort of extreme end of what politicization of analysis can look like. And then I contrasted it with what happened with the Trinidad Aragua assessment, with a much more senior officer who stood by our values after a long career and paid for it with his career. And that what it is designed to illustrate is the dilemma for the individual officer, which is that if you go along and get along, the benefits to you are immediate, and the consequences to the country are borne by everybody. Whereas if you stand up and speak truth to power, the consequences to you are terrible and immediate in this case, and the country sort of as a whole will benefit, but most of the time, no one will ever know your name. And so we treated this as a value system, as a professional ethic. We created structures to ensure that officers should not have to risk their careers by speaking truth. And we've systematically destroyed those under this administration in a way that I have not seen in previous administrations. I just want to emphasize that while previous administrations have politicized or tried to, and I have been a policymaker myself when I looked at analysis that came to me, I was like, what do you mean it's not going to work? But I didn't go after the careers of the officers. I didn't smear them in public. I didn't try to take away their security clearances so after government, they couldn't even work in their own profession. That retaliatory toolbook is something that only this administration in my lifetime has used, and it's been incredibly destructive to the ICBMs.
Is it ongoing?
Yeah.
The first big expulsions were reported on months ago, a year ago. What about now? Is it it's still going on? Are still people still being forced out? Do you know of friends that had to leave?
I do. I'm not going to talk about them here, but it's it it
but
you're,
in general,
you're correct in this in the trajectory that it is much less than it was at the beginning. And I think that the reason is that it worked. That the most for the most part, the dissent is no longer coming. People have learned the lesson. Most of the product of it is not people rewriting assessments to conform. It's just to avoid and to not warn. And so the value of the intelligence community has been greatly reduced.
When you say not warn, what just looking at it do you think the warnings are missing about? You know, what do you see looming ahead as things that you would worry are being left out, not just silenced because those people are gone, but geopolitically, when we look at the world and what could happen? And there's an amazing way in which this White House does not seem scared. You know, you mentioned retaliation before. They don't seem to be leading with what could happen that we need to protect ourselves from. At least that's how I see it. Maybe you disagree. And so the question is, what are, if from a rational point of view, even not a classified information point of view, where are the insecurities to the U.S. security coming from?
I, first of all, I would say it is sort of inexplicable to the degree to which the administration doesn't seem to see itself responsible for bad things happening to the United States. And just one of the recent things was it was reported in the press that the Iranians were responsible for cyber attacks against several American states. And the president's response was to blame the governor of Minnesota, Governor Waltz, who was his opponent in the previous election, and to deny effectively that it had been a foreign actor interfering. Like that was the priority, was to score political
points.
Just to
clarify here, we're talking about the suspected, strongly suspected Iranian responsibility for infiltration of water systems, water control systems, chiefly in the Midwest.
Yeah, so just the focus on that rather than remediating the problem of American water supplies being interfered with. So in terms of if you were an analyst at CIA or elsewhere and you were trying to keep your job and trying to not run afoul of the administration, it's fairly obvious. And I don't have any special knowledge that's recent on this. Just to say that when the president is in the public cherry-picking intelligence on election interference, and you're then subsequently charged with writing a paper on election interference, whether it's the Russians or the Chinese, you know where the landmines are going to be. You know that it'll either be ignored because it's not what they want to hear, or you'll be retaliated against for providing the wrong answer. And so the rational thing to do is to call in sick or get out of the building or try to avoid this assignment. And it's hard to blame individuals for not falling over on their sword when it will make no difference to the outcome because the organization's already been captured and was willing to go along with it. The time to fight this was a long time ago. And unfortunately, there's very little bit to be gained for an individual in doing that. And I know people are trying their best and they're holding the line as best they can, but it is a really impossible situation. So if you're working China, Russia, you know, anything to do with Iran, you have to be looking over your shoulder. And I cannot imagine they're providing the best analysis that the White House needs to make good decisions. And you see it in astonishing things like just like a week or two ago, we saw this report out of the Pentagon where because the war is going badly and we can't figure out any ways of resolving this, they had sent an email effectively trying to crowdsource ideas for how to break the stalemate against the Iranians. And I saw that and it just like if only there was some sort of a council that could sit and discuss national security matters and ask for the intelligence community to provide assessments on this. Gosh, what would that even be called? Right. And that we've been reduced to this level of amateurishness in a war that has killed at least 14 soldiers. It's an amazing occurrence that there isn't greater outrage, that Congress has not demanded stronger answers from the administration, But it's where we are. So it's one of the reasons why I felt compelled to speak out.
These are not abstract theoretical questions involving policy. People are getting killed. That's what makes this all too real. Julia, thanks so much for coming on the Spy Talk podcast. You've offered some really valuable insights, and we really appreciate it. So thank you.
Thanks, Jeff. And sorry for being such a downer.
Debbie Downer.
So this is what you get when you call an analyst. You know, we have the black armband and all that. But
yeah,
it's
your
really
job, to deliver the bad news a lot of the time. And most presidents have appreciated it. To a certain degree.
This is true.
But this one, they don't want to hear bad news. So, and who's going to tell them?
And it's been to their detriment, unfortunately, and all of ours.
On that happy note, we have to leave it there.
It's great to get to talk to you, though.
Thanks so much. And that's it for this week's Spy Talk. Be sure to check out our complete podcast archive on Apple or wherever you get your podcasts. And if you haven't already, do check out the spytalk.co news site on Substack, where we offer steady diet of scoops and original analyses from the intersection of intelligence, foreign policy, and military operations. Just Google Spy Talk and you'll quickly find your way there. This edition of the Spy Talk podcast was smoothly produced, as always, by Kanai and expertly edited by Molly Hawkey for MSW Media. That's it. See you around. I'm Jeff Stein.
I'm Karen Greenberg.
Thanks for listening.
For more original reporting and insights like this, subscribe to spytalk.co on Substack and follow us on Twitter at @talk_spy. If you enjoyed our podcast, subscribe and leave a review on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.
MSW Media.
It's no surprise that newsmakers try to manipulate the audience. They want you to believe that they are the one holding the line, and they'll use any trick they can to get you there. But don't let them fool you. Get unspun. I'm Amanda Sturgill. I've been a reporter, and today I teach future reporters to cut the spin and think critically about what newsmakers say. My podcast, Unspun, shows you how to know when you're being manipulated by the news. Learn to spot the tricks and how to make up your own mind about what's true. So if you're tired of being fooled by the news, subscribe to Unspun today. Unspun, because you deserve the truth.
Hello, Martin Sheen here, and I have a question for you. What do you do on Sunday to relax and unwind? Sleep in, read the paper, eat stuff you shouldn't? Binge watch the shows on your My Stuff list? Okay, all good and fine, but I think this routine could be a bit better. Let me offer something to make your me time really special, my podcast. And I think once you hear it, you'll realize it is the perfect addition to your Sunday or whenever you're looking for a chance to unwind. Tune in as I share the stories of my life along with some poetry and an occasional personal reflection in a way that will have you saying, "That was time well spent, and I didn't even have to get out of my pajamas." Season 4 of the Martin Sheen podcast, with yours truly, Martin Sheen, of course, is underway with 10 brand new episodes. I know our lives can be very busy and demanding these days. Whose are not? So join me on a storytelling journey that you can enjoy from the comfort of your favorite easy chair and a chance to relax and be in the moment. So check out the Martin Sheen podcast, season 4, underway right now, and make it part of your self-care routine. And as always, thank you for listening.